beginning with the massacre on Tuun and ending with the attack on Coruscant's Verity District. This is my confession.
From there, he listed a seemingly endless series of operations, specifying his role in each. Quell didn't recognize all of them. Of those she did recognize, many had been planned by Colonel Nerys, not Keyes. And when he spoke of Operation Cinder, both the first and second Cinder, he made no mention of the Emperor's messenger or the military chain of command, emphasizing his personal involvement above all else. He described ways he had enforced discipline and obedience, few of which were true. Even in death, she thought, Keyes sought to protect his people. If he couldn't save every Imperial soldier, he would try to save the 204th by sacrificing his reputation, sparing others New Republic justice, and being remembered as a war criminal. Maybe he had believed. And if his conviction had led him to slaughter millions, how could she hate him when her own lack of conviction had still resulted in Necronus? She would never know the truth of his soul, or whether her admiration for him was justified or a remnant of the Empire's conditioning. "I wish you'd been a better man," she whispered to the hologram before it disappeared. She wondered, in the last glimmer of the Hollow's light, whether she would have felt the same admiration if Syndulla had been her mentor from the start, if she would have seen any worthy qualities in Keyes at all. She supposed it didn't matter. "Come on," she said to the droid, and they left toward the daylight spilling in through the crawlway. Three.
"Don't move."
Will wasn't sure he could have moved if he'd wanted to. He lay very still in the escape pod and left his eyes closed to shut out the brightness seeping through the viewport. He was still delirious, he thought, but his hearing had returned. He should have been worried about his friends, but none of their faces would stay fixed in his mind.
"I'm seeing a lot of blood, but we can't leave you here."
There was the sound of something heavy shifting. The pod door, maybe?
"Where'd you come from? The Ravager? The Eviscerator?"
He didn't recognize those ships. Something seemed wrong with the question.
"The Deliverance," he said.
There was a long pause. Will finally opened his eyes and saw a black helmet looking down at him. Oxygen tubes ran from the helmet to a chest piece.
"What's your name?"
the TIE pilot asked.
"Will,"
he said.
"Will Lark."
The pilot cocked his head and looked down at him a long while before laughing. The sound was muffled by the helmet, but it sounded fresh and joyous.
"Hell of a thing. I've heard a lot about you, Will Lark. Let's get you home safe."
He felt gloved hands on his body, touching him gently at first to see where he flinched from the pain, then working to bring him upright. Will had 1,000 questions, but no voice. Amazement swallowed all his words. Nath flew low above the desert, kicking up enough dust to muddy the Y-Wing's sensors and make T5 grumble.
I know, Nath growled, but much higher in the bioscanners won't do any good. Not to mention, we'll be that much clearer a target for any ground troops. Looks like nobody told them the battle's over.
He increased his altitude anyway and angled toward the rocky hills at the desert's edge, too stumpy and eroded to be called mountains. T5 sent a metallurgical report to his console. Plenty of scraps, a few massive wrecks, nothing that looked like a whole fighter or escape pod within 5 kilometers, and he waited for life readings.
"Probably better if nothing shows," he thought. "It'll only mean trouble."
He knew he was lying to himself. If anyone from his squadron was alive, he meant to find them no matter the danger. After knocking out the bulk freighter, he'd spent the rest of the battle repairing his ship, keeping his distance from the fighting and sniping at any TIEs that got close. He hadn't fled the system. He'd even recorded escape pod trajectories from afar. His alibi wouldn't hold up to close examination, and he wouldn't come out looking like much of a hero compared with Lieutenant Itina and the others who'd returned to the fray. But he'd stayed alive when many, maybe most, of the crew and pilots of the Deliverance hadn't. He'd made the best choice he could. The only choice, if he was to be true to himself. The New Republic, galactic peace, all that garbage. Will and Chass had believed. Quell and Kairos, too. Nath Tenzint, though? He'd fooled a lot of people and nearly fooled himself, but he'd never truly bought into the dream of a better world. He'd just surrounded himself with zealots, and that made good camouflage. Besides, he'd neutralized an enemy that might have cost the New Republic the battle. He'd be damned if he felt guilty for not doing more than that. T5 pinged loudly and sent over a new report. Nath frowned and tapped the screen.
Homing beacon, huh? You sure it's from the Deliverance?
T5 chimed once.
All right, we'll take a look.
He adjusted his course to take him deeper into the hills. They'd spotted plenty of escape pods already, including a few from the Deliverance that hadn't survived landing, and he had to suppress the hope rising in him. If Will had somehow made it out... He ignored the thought. The great piles of dun rocks blurred, and he cut his speed, allowing his sensors to recalibrate. In the distance, he spotted a glint, something metallic matching the beacon's coordinates, half buried in a landslide. He switched to bioscanners. No life signs at the pod's location, but there were two signatures in motion less than a kilometer away. Instinct told him to open his throttle and hurtle toward the site, but he cut speed again until he was moving slow enough to see whatever was on the ground. Slow enough to guarantee he'd be blown out of the sky if he turned out to be chasing a stormtrooper with a surface-to-air rocket.
Come on, brother. Be out there.
He passed over a hilltop, and T5 squealed so fiercely that Nath was sure for an instant they were under attack, that he'd made the fatal mistake he'd been dreading all day, and that he was going to die not in battle but on a rescue mission. He grinned at the irony, ready to face his final moments, then understood the droid's reaction. In a narrow valley ahead, two figures trekked among the scree. One wore the black suit of a TIE pilot. The other was lean and dressed in what looked like shredded civilian clothes, supporting himself with an arm around the pilot's shoulders.
You sure?
Nath asked.
You sure it's him?
He pushed the Y-Wing as low as he could without choking the survivors with grit. T5 was beeping in the affirmative, and as they came closer, Nath got a better look. Will Lark was hobbling through the sand and gravel, leaning into his companion and laughing. The TIE pilot's helmet was off, and the expression Nath saw was similarly joyous. They looked like two siblings reunited after years as they waved frantically at the Y-Wing. Nath felt a grudging sense of admiration and amusement. Maybe all Will's outreach to the enemy hadn't been wrongheaded. He'd just been playing the long game.
You call it into the New Republic, all right?
He told the droid.
Convince them it's a priority pickup. Don't mention Will's name in case he's tagged as a deserter. Just tell them it's a wounded man from the Deliverance and patch me through if they don't take it serious.
He circled around to reassure the pair they'd been spotted, but he didn't look for a place to land. He didn't have room in the Y-Wing for a passenger or any supplies to offer. More to the point, he didn't have anything to say to Will Lark after everything they'd been through. If Nath had been wrong about Will's choice to leave the squadron, well... Will had vindication without an admission from Nath. And the kid would be better off, not knowing Nath had disappointed him in the end, leaving the battle before the last of the work was done. Their paths were separating. Nath was glad Will was alive. T5 made a disappointed noise.
Not this time,
Nath said.
Come on. Chass's odds are worse, but we're not writing her off until we've picked through more wreckage than this. If she brought that B-Wing down, it should be within a few hundred kilometers of where the Deliverance dropped its pods.
He trailed off as Will and the TIE pilot came back into sight. Both were looking skyward, away from the Y-Wing, pointing to something in the clouds in the obscuring light of the western sun. Five. Chasna Chadic wasn't sure if she'd made a mistake. She was alive. That was a shock by itself, really. Her cockpit had stayed intact after the loss of her airfoil, doubling as an escape pod as it tumbled and tangled with wreckage, finally falling to Jakku in the torn open belly of a star destroyer. She could see sky and mountains and even a swath of desert from the remains of her bomber high in the warship's hull. And she thought it wasn't the worst view to die with. Because she was dying. She'd chosen life, only to be crushed between her seat and her console. Her legs were numb. Her arm was burnt. She was bleeding out very slowly. And she was thirsty. She'd chosen life, and what she had to look forward to was a lingering death over hours or days. Maybe she'd have been better off with the blaze of glory. She alternated between states of boredom, when she counted the specks of ships crossing the sky, or tried to guess how long she'd been trapped, or attempted to catalog every song from her lost collection, and blossoming panic, when she wondered if there was a way to hasten her death, or grew terrified by the thought of being rescued and never recovering, suffering the same nightmare future as usual, only this time without legs. Sometimes she prayed the way her cults had prayed, only with a simple message to one man. Nath Tenzint, find me. You said you'd shoot me if I needed you to shoot me. Find me. Jakku was hot, and her oxygen recirculators had failed. Sometimes she licked the sweat salt off her lips and chin. Some hours into her ordeal, she saw a flying speck that didn't move like a ship. It descended in canted circles and slowed and sped at odd moments, and when it came closer, she thought she saw outspread wings. Other specks followed, and she wondered if they were carrion birds come to scavenge the dead. That didn't seem right for a desert world like Jakku. Would carrion birds be so big? But people said strange things lived in the western reaches. Each bird, upon descending to a certain altitude, ceased spiraling downward and headed out over its own strip of desert. She made out enormous iridescent wings, stubby heads, and outstretched claws. She wondered if she was hallucinating when she saw that on the back of each creature sat a humanoid rider, limbs wrapped tight around their mount while craning their neck to see below. Chas didn't understand. She felt lucid and awake. She stared as several birds and their riders dropped out of her sight, then returned to the sky minutes later bearing burdens that might have been bodies. She recalled stories her mother had told her, before the cults, when Chas had been no older than 3 or 4, of spirits from the sky who carried the souls of the dying to another world. Then she recalled a different story, Will Lark's story, of the 120 of Polinius, who had learned to fly the great beasts of their homeworld. She remembered Will slipping away during the journey to Jakku before announcing his resignation. She began to laugh as she realized that, deserter or not, alive or not, he'd done his part one last time. 119 Will Larks were out there, all searching for survivors. Chas lay back, closed her eyes, and waited. Six. Outside the crawlway on the repulsor lift platform, Erica Quell found Kairos among the living. The woman stood straight-backed in her stained and torn garments, despite the new cracks in the chitinous plates covering her face and the thick fluid like blood or pus welling at those plates' edges. She looked like she'd survived catastrophe, more than a 50-meter fall, more than a battle on an occupied world at the center of the galaxy, yet remained brave and unbowed. You brought it up the turbo lift shaft? Quell asked, indicating the astromech behind her with a tilt of her head.
Yes,
Kairos said.
Thank you,
Quell said. Then, faster.
And for what you did up there. I would have died if I'd been alone.
Yes,
Kairos said, apparently without humor. Quell smiled anyway. She swallowed it and searched Kairos for any indication of weakness. She found what might have been weariness instead. A slight sag in the woman's shoulders, a sway in her arms, but nothing specific to injury.
Are you okay? Physically, I mean?
Yes,
Kairos said a third time. There was quiet delight in the word.
Are you?
I'm bruised. I'm sure I broke something. I always do.
She glanced at her flight suit and shrugged.
The blood isn't mine.
I know.
Kairos cocked her head, and Quell saw that one of the plates had begun to detach from whatever was underneath, like a peeling scab or an eggshell separating from its membrane.
They won. The New Republic won at Jakku. There are broadcasts playing in the Undercity.
Good.
It was an inane thing to say, but Quell had been resigned to a New Republic victory since shortly after the Battle of Endor. Hearing the news now felt like a statement of the obvious. Even as she thought this, however, she began to tremble. The galaxy had changed, and it would be the New Republic that would define the way she lived, the way everyone lived, forevermore. It was a profound change, even if her instinct was to reject it. She thought she was glad.
Anything from the squadron?
Quell asked.
No. The transmitter was destroyed.
She paused, and Quell expected her to say, I hope they are well, or I'm sure they survived, or even, they might be dead. But that wasn't Kairos's way, and Quell pushed aside her own worry as Kairos added,
I think it will be dangerous here soon. Find a place in the city where no one will look until the New Republic comes.
Quell nodded, though she wasn't sure how she would find safety. She didn't know Coruscant, and on foot the vastness of the city, the way the sky hid behind the tallest buildings, even near the upper levels, was intimidating, the way the confines of the generator crawlway had been comforting. She was bred for claustrophobia, for artificial lights and hard vacuum outside her windows. The droid behind her buzzed quietly as if offering its assistance. It was only then that Kairos's phrasing struck her.
What about you?
Quell asked.
You are my sister, and the heir to those dear to me. But I have made my judgment, and you no longer need me.
That's not an answer.
She understood more than she would have expected, but she was too tired, too overwhelmed by all the day's events to fully comprehend.
Are you coming with me?
I am pleased for Aiden and ITO,
Kairos said, with something like the interrogation droid's amused tolerance.
I am pleased you've become what you are. I am changing too, and I am ready to move beyond my bond to this war.
Are you dying?
Quell's voice was suddenly small.
I am changing.
Kairos stroked the loose chitin. Only a thin film held the plate to her face now, and other plates had begun sliding free as well.
The ship is gone. My chrysalis is broken. The war is ended, and only you remain of those whose blood and spirit mixed with mine. Now you have changed, and I am becoming...
Kairos mouthed something and shuddered, as if struggling with the limits of language.
I cannot return to my people,
Kairos said, and turned away from Quell to face the city.
I will not be a shaman or a warrior anymore. I am new, Irika Quell, and the first thing to touch my skin will not be linked to pain or destruction.
The first chitin plate dropped to the platform with a wet smack. Another piece hung from her chin. Quell wanted to step forward. She stayed where she was.
Can I look at you?
No,
Kairos said, and there was ecstasy in her voice.
What I become next will not be what I was. I am leaving, and I will find a place where I do not need a shell, where my spirit and blood resonate with the air and life around me.
What does that mean? Where are you going?
Kairos placed her hands over her face and turned, just enough to look back at Quell. Just enough for Quell to see one of the woman's dark eyes and a glimpse of something below the peeling chitin like newborn flesh.
Somewhere beautiful. I will find it. Be very well, my sister.
With that, Kairos turned again and stepped to the edge of the platform. When she jumped, a small motion, a quick bending of the knees and a spring, Quell caught her breath and rushed to the edge, stepping over a trail of ichor. She looked down and saw a narrow catwalk 10 meters below the platform, and Kairos, or whoever she was now, striding briskly and comfortably, lightly along it, towards some destination Quell couldn't fathom. Quell began laughing and knelt on the metal.
Be very well, my sister,
she echoed, as if the woman could read her thoughts. And she felt tears on her cheeks, and the longer she knelt, the more came. She wept not only for Kairos and for the loss of Kairos, but for all the pain and joy she'd experienced, yet never allowed to surface. She looked out at the city, tears falling onto the levels below like rain, and with the droid behind her, she smiled and wondered what the future would bring for all of them. Part 4. Victory's Price. Chapter 25. Enduring Scars of Flesh and Spirit. 1.
So, what are we going to do about Lieutenant Quell?
Hera Syndulla stood across from Mon Mothma, Chancellor of the New Republic and leader of the known galaxy, as the human poured 2 glasses of water from a ceramic ewer sculpted to resemble a Skakoan squid. After she'd spoken, Mothma crossed the vast office and returned to Hera's side, passing her one of the glasses as they settled into cream-colored armchairs. The synth leather seemed to envelop Hera as she leaned back. In that moment, she was certain it was the most comfortable chair she'd ever sat in. She'd barely slept in the weeks since Jakku, and this meeting on Nakadiya had been her most pleasurable task in a while. The war was over, but the challenges never stopped.
Have you talked to her personally? Hera asked.
She recognized the crease of Mothma's brow, the line added to her already lined face, the indication that she'd delegated a task she felt responsible for to someone she didn't altogether trust.
I saw transcripts of her interviews, but I haven't had the time. For what it's worth, intelligence has confirmed her story. The security footage from Coruscant shows her and Keyes exactly as she reported. I told you she would cooperate. You did, and I believed you.
Mothma's lips quirked into a smile. Hera read the meaning. I believed you, but it's my job to make sure.
She is comfortable, by the way. I had one of my people arrange it. House arrest, but an apartment is more comfortable than a cell. I wish you could talk to her, Hera said, then added, thank you.
Mothma sipped her water.
Intelligence has sent upward of 50 agents, plus security, to study the databank Keyes attempted to destroy. It's encrypted, but we've already unlocked sections, and Kraken is confident we'll have the rest in time. He says we'd have stumbled onto it sooner or later, but that Quell's information gave us a tremendous head start. Like you, he's requested an expedited hearing to determine her status.
Hera frowned.
Meaning, intelligence wants her freedom contingent on her continued assistance?
Meaning he wants to know what's happening. One way or the other. I don't blame him for that.
It was a rebuke so gentle and subtle, Hera almost didn't catch it. She nodded to indicate she understood. New Republic intelligence was picking up where the military had left off, following up on thousands of leads daily, and trying to assess a galaxy's worth of threats. General Kraken needed to know what assets he had to work with. Hera felt fortunate not to be in his position.
The hearing won't amount to much, of course, Mothma went on. We're not equipped for it yet, so expediting means I pull strings until our overworked advocates sign off on whatever I decide.
She sighed.
Tell me what you think of her. I'm not asking you to shoulder the burden, but give me your opinion as someone who was there.
Hera had been awaiting the question for days. She still wasn't sure how to answer.
I think, she said, attempting to read Mothma's expression and failing, that Quell's actions after Cerberon, regardless of authorization, were laudable. She infiltrated an enemy unit without assistance or a means to coordinate with our forces, and she led us to the 204th despite those obstacles. That saved countless lives on Chatawa. And if we'd never found Shadow Wing at Chatawa, we wouldn't have been prepared to deal with them at Jakku. How much she contributed to Keyes's work is arguable, but she ultimately reported on Keyes's plans for Coruscant and personally stopped who knows how many deaths during that attack. She didn't exactly come back willingly, Mothma said. Two of your pilots had to retrieve her.
Chasna Chadic and Kairos defied orders, Hera shook her head. I'm confident neither of them was diplomatic about it, but I'm not going to assume Quell wouldn't have returned on her own. She didn't have the chance.
All right. Granted.
Mothma lifted her glass while her eyes remained on Hera.
Now, say the rest.
They knew each other too well, liked each other too much to play games.
Let's get to the truth, then. Quell's record with the 204th is concerning, even before Endor, Hera said. And when I chose her to lead a squadron, I didn't realize the extent of her actions after the Emperor's death. None of us did. She was a willing participant in Operation Cinder, and she was actively involved in the destruction of Necronus, and she lied about it. I like Quell. I believe she's changed. But her victims can't speak up because their civilization died with their planet, and I can't ignore that.
It hurt to say the words. If Hera had trusted Mothma any less, she would have kept them to herself.
It would be easier, Mothma said quietly, if we weren't setting precedent. If the decision could be sealed, like it would be in the Empire, never subjected to public view, with no consequences, no one to answer to but our own peculiar consciences.
Hera laughed dubiously.
Is that an option?
Maybe if Keyes's attack and post-mortem proclamation hadn't been so public. Maybe if fewer people knew, but no. Justice works best in daylight anyway, and practically speaking, we were going to encounter a case like hers sooner rather than later.
Meaning?
I'm not looking to make an example of her,
Mothma said, too swiftly for someone who hadn't considered the possibility.
But this is the start of a very long process. The Emperor's databank cataloging his people's atrocities isn't public knowledge, and the Senate hasn't yet determined the full process for trying Imperials outside the topmost levels of government. Each of those items impacts the other, all of which is to say, Soren Keyes wasn't entirely wrong to believe the databank is a potential threat to a lasting peace.
Hera arched her brow.
You read those transcripts pretty closely. I did.
She shrugged.
I believe in justice. I also believe that for the galaxy to survive, reconciliation must occur. The New Republic will not hold together if we spend the next 10 or 20 or 50 years divided into rebel and imperial. Yet true reconciliation requires honesty. It requires we stare at what we've done as a civilization and come to terms with it. The databank can help, but only if the Senate and the galaxy as a whole has the appetite for self-examination over revenge.
Especially since the databank gives us an endless list of crimes to seek justice or revenge for, Hera agreed. You can't blame people for wanting restitution from ex-Imperials.
No, and I don't object on principle. Pity those ex-Imperials make up a dangerously large portion of our population. Quell has the poor luck of being at the start of the line. I won't make her an example, but she will send a message whether we intend it or not.
Hera stood and stepped to a small window looking onto the surrounding settlement. Nacadia was an agri-world, uncosmopolitan, and formerly ignored by most of the galaxy, symbolically perfect for the latest seat of the New Republic government. Its buildings were squat and simple, and Hera could see where they disappeared into fields of grain just before the horizon. But Nacadia had seen its share of fighting, battles few people besides the Nacadians remembered. Even Hera only vaguely recalled the reports, yet she was sure the Emperor's databank named soldiers who'd inflicted suffering on the locals. How many nightmares, she wondered, did Nacadians endure every night because no one acknowledged their pain? And yet, she thought, and yet.
One last thought, Hera said. If I may. Always,
Mothma said. Hera turned from the window and looked at the Chancellor. She wasn't the orator Mothma was. She didn't have to be so long as she was clear and direct and true.
The rebellion got dirty sometimes, but the dream was pure. The ideal was pure. If we were still rebels, we would have forgiven her, and you know it. I don't like the thought that winnings made us harder.
Nor do I,
Mothma conceded.
But there are luxuries we no longer have. We were a storm. Shifting and chaotic, battering the walls of a fortress of evil. Now we're rebuilding where that fortress stood, and I have to consider whether each stone in our foundation can carry the weight of the future.
They were silent a while. Eventually, Hera decided she'd been dismissed and began to walk toward the door. Mothma stopped her with a gesture.
Still, if we lock Irika Quell away for her crimes, after everything she's done to redeem herself.
She sighed and smiled sadly before finishing.
What hope do any of them have?
Hera had seen pictures of Quell before she'd ever met her, from Cairn Aiden's dossiers. Quell's images had been taken during New Republic processing after her surrender on Necronus, when she'd been covered in cuts and bruises, one arm in a sling. She'd had a glass-like sharpness then, as if she'd been equally likely to shatter or to injure. There was no brittleness to her now, as she sat on a low table in the apartment she'd been assigned. She was thin, and her hair had grown out so that wisps often fell in front of her eyes. But she looked unafraid and certain of herself. When Hera had entered, she'd noticed the deliberate way Quell had relaxed her shoulders and turned and taken her seat. The movements of a civilian hosting a visitor, not an officer seeing a superior. Hera squatted across from Quell and said,
"You're going free."
Quell furrowed her brow.
"What?" "Chancellor Mothma says you're going to go free. There's even a medal in it. I'm not sure which one. For exceptional bravery and service on Coruscant."
She smiled as she said it. Quell's expression remained flat.
"I don't understand,"
Quell said. She wrapped the fingers of her right hand around her left wrist, stroking her arm.
"I don't understand."
Hera softened her tone.
"There were several requests for an expedited decision about your status. Mothma looked at your case just yesterday, and it's all finalized as of this afternoon."
Quell said nothing, so Hera went on.
"It's not a full pardon. The Senate's debating putting restrictions on ex-Imperial troops with certain records. Limited voting rights, weapons prohibitions, that sort of thing. There are a few bills under consideration. Mothma thinks it'll end up varying planet to planet, but..."
She laughed softly.
"I'm rambling. You're free, Irika. Congratulations."
Quell stood from the table, took several paces, and turned back. Hera stood as well. This time she waited.
"No consequences at all,"
Quell said.
"That's what it ends in? You faced your share of consequences." "I certainly don't deserve a medal,"
Quell said. She laughed scornfully.
"You know that." What you deserve, Harris said calmly, is a question for philosophers. If you're looking for unfailing judgment from a one-year-old government, you're going to the wrong place.
Quill closed her eyes and nodded.
I take your point.
There was a self-awareness in the words that made Hera flinch.
You've never had good experiences looking to government for moral guidance, have you?
She stepped toward Quell, slowly enough that she could halt and back away if the woman showed discomfort. But Quell stayed put, and Hera put a hand on her shoulder.
If you don't like the medal, Hera said, think of it as a political decision. There are a lot of people with opinions on what should happen with you and people like you. But the Chancellor thinks this is best for the New Republic. A way to signal to ex-Imperials that even if their leaders can't go free, there's a path to normalcy for them. Mothma also thinks, I think, that if it's not perfect justice, it's still close to fair. Can you live with that?
She felt Quell's shoulder rise and fall as the woman took slow breaths. Quell looked quietly bereft, as if recalling a death grieved long ago.
Yes, Quell said. I have to. Come on, Hera said and squeezed her shoulder. Let's get something to eat.
They didn't go far from Quell's apartment. They found an outdoor table at a sparsely occupied cafe where locals played Dejarik and grumbled about off-worlders driving up prices. Hera paid for the meal. Local fare, a ground nut stew for herself and thin seafood porridge for Quell, and carried the conversation. She talked about her father and her homeworld, and her desire to visit Ryloth again. She said little about the more difficult decisions she had to make, about her military commission, or about her son. Quell needed normalcy, not stress. Hera had other friends she could lean on. After they finished, Hera walked Quell back to her apartment and said,
Think of what you've been given as an opportunity. It's not a reward. It's not vindication for what you've done or haven't done. It's a chance to do something fresh with your life. I don't know what that would be, Quell said. When you find it, you will.
With that, Hera bid Erica Quell farewell. 2. The Rim's Edge Cantina was mostly stairs. Broad platforms holding tables and chairs, narrow staircases leading up and down the dark stone walls, mazes of stairs that led nowhere. And Nath Tenzant felt every one in his knees. He was getting old. He wasn't old yet, but he was getting there. He'd been to the Rim's Edge once before, the better part of a decade ago. Back then, it had been a dank pit in an abandoned monastery on a nameless planet bordering the unknown regions, sparsely occupied by outcasts drinking nervously in the cavernous space. It was still a dank pit, but now, 4 months after the Battle of Jakku, the planet was named Free Rock, and the cantina was packed with everyone from pirates to Jakku refugees to explorers and fortune seekers and ex-Imperials in hiding. Nath pushed his way through a cluster of Rhodian prospectors and spotted his man in a corner alcove. It wasn't a smart place to sit. It was high enough to afford a good view of the cantina, but it left nowhere to run. Nath hauled himself up the last few steps, approaching the table.
You look light on cash, brother,
Nath said.
Buy you a drink?
He dropped into a chair before the man could object. Nath's table mate was short and lean, with slick black hair that crept down his scalp like a mass of untended vines.
Not looking for company,
the man said.
Sure you are, Bansu Ro,
Nath said.
You're just not looking for me.
He leaned back in the flimsy wooden chair and spread his arms as wide as he could to show he wasn't holding a weapon.
Make yourself a nice big target,
Nath told himself.
Put him at ease. You know my name,
Bansu said.
I know a lot of things about you. Been doing some reading. I know you were born on Lothal, though you split from your family when they sided with the rebels. That taint stuck with you at the Imperial Academy, and you almost ended up with a career making shuttle runs, only...
Captain Tenzant,
Bansu said. Nath grinned as he watched the man's hand go to his right hip.
You sold your blaster this morning, remember? I was going to say, only the 204th Imperial Fighter Wing liked your aptitude tests and took you in.
Bansu scowled. He scanned the room rapidly before returning his attention to Nath.
You hunting us down for Syndulla? Irika Quell tell you all about me? Yes to the second, though I also pulled a lot from your intelligence files, but no to the first. I'm not working for the New Republic anymore. The hero of Troyth gave up his loyalties?
Bansu's hand went to his left hip now, where Nath glimpsed the hilt of a vibroknife.
I don't think so. You clearly haven't seen my file.
Nath shrugged. It wasn't the first time he'd heard that particular sentiment, and he tried not to let it rankle him. Either the reputation would fade, or he'd find a way to capitalize on it.
Look, you're in dire straits, so you may as well hear my pitch. I'm offering you a way to resolve all your current troubles.
And purchase new ones?
Nath grinned.
Exactly. You see, I'm putting a crew together.
Bansu Rowe said nothing.
I'm not a patriot or a true believer. Just looking to earn a profit and do some good. I was thinking about my next move and said to myself, there's some fine out-of-work pilots out there. Maybe see what you can do for them. Be charitable, Nath. See, I've already won over your friends Crete and Nord Candende. That kid was in a real bad spot, let me tell you. And I've got a list of other candidates for recruitment. There are plenty of credits out there for a team of freelancers with the right guidance.
Nord Candende is an idiot,
Bansu Rowe said.
Got you,
Nath thought.
Sure is,
he agreed.
But you do like Crete, don't you? And it's not like you got a lot of other options.
He was interrupted by a series of squeals and pings behind him. He held up a hand to Bansu in the universal wait just a minute signal and turned to T5.
What? What took you?
Nath asked.
You couldn't handle the stairs?
The droid emitted a staccato set of buzzes. Nath felt his muscles tense.
All right,
he said, then turned back to Bansu and slapped his palm on the table.
Got some business to see to. You think about what I said. Swing by Roderick's in a few hours if you want to talk more.
Bansu Rowe looked bewildered as Nath rose from the table and followed T5 out of the cantina.
Check if there's a bounty on him,
Nath muttered to the droid.
Just in case you blew my only shot.
5 minutes later, they were in a decaying cloister on the opposite side of the outpost. Nath's Y-wing sat on the scorched and cracked paving stones, and standing before the vessel was a thin, olive-skinned youth wearing a simple tunic and pants. The youth ran fingertips over a section of the ship's nose that had been freshly painted and repaired. Only a few traces of the old squadron insignia remained.
Gotta say,
Nath called,
I'm real curious about how you found me.
Will Lark turned and smiled, and Nath forced himself not to react at the sight of the boy's reconstructed face. The medical droids had done good, patching in artificial bone around his nose, right cheek, and eye socket, but there were visible seams and webs of scarring where organic flesh met synth skin.
It's not important,
Will said, and crossed the cloister until he stood with Nath and T5.
It's good to see you. You too,
Nath said, which was the truth, though he suspected neither of them would leave without ill feelings.
You didn't just get out of...
No. No.
Will's smile flickered.
After the med center, I was recuperating on Polinius a while. I've been traveling 2 weeks now. Good. No trouble with Syndulla then?
No one mentioned the word deserter, if that's what you're asking.
I know there are people who blame me, but, well, I think my people helped sway opinions behind the scenes. Hell, you earned the right to do whatever you want. Everything you did with Alphabet? You deserve a medal more than me.
Maybe.
But you wear it better.
Nath snorted and glanced about the cloister. Something moved in the shadows. One of the ghost monks, as the locals called them.
Look, I'd love to catch up, but it's kind of a delicate moment. Can we meet back tomorrow morning? I can buy you a good meal. Decent meal, anyway, good as they come around here. And maybe we can find some trouble with the...
What are you doing here, Nath?
Will sounded tired, as if an exhaustion in his bones had metastasized into his voice.
Taking care of some business? Nothing worth talking about.
Isn't it?
The tone was pointed. Then Will briskly shook his head.
I'm sorry. It's been a long trip, and I'm glad you're all right. And here I am giving you a hard time.
Nath gestured dismissively as he curled his lips into a smile. They'd reached the moment faster than he'd expected.
Probably for the best, he thought.
Go ahead and say what you want to say. Figure we can be frank with each other.
Will looked about. Maybe he'd spotted a ghost monk too. Then back to Nath.
I know a little about where you've been. I know you were at Onkoral a while, and that you transferred a lot of credits to one of the weaponeers there. I know you spent about a week at an outpost on the edge of the Sovereign Latitudes.
Nath laughed, and Will, startled, paused. Nath explained,
They just call them the Pirate Territories these days.
The Pirate Territories, then. I followed up at Gangsy Station, too. The point is, that's all enough to make a person worried.
You don't know half of it, brother.
Nothing about Nedelich, or the other places Nath had made contact with Shadow Wing. Or Will was holding back, but Nath didn't think that was likely.
Nasha Gravis send you?
Nath asked.
She didn't send me,
Will said, which struck Nath as careful phrasing.
I don't know what you're doing, and it's not my place to tell you how to live. But you are my friend, and it scares me to think you're going back to the sort of business you were in before the rebels.
If he hadn't known Will better, he would have felt patronized. He could see Will choosing his approach delicately, trying to frame it all for Nath's benefit. But he also trusted Will's sincerity, and the effort wasn't manipulative, just misguided.
I appreciate the concern. You know as well as I do I take pretty good care of myself.
I do. Of course I do.
And that the New Republic was never going to be a good fit for me long term. The Rebellion was fine. Plenty of breathing room there, and the cell leaders needed all the help they could get. But I've never been a law and order type. All those rules were starting to chafe.
More than they did in the Empire?
Will cocked his head.
I can't believe that.
Empire had rules, but it didn't have so many expectations. Not where I was stationed, anyway. Made the whole business a lot more palatable.
It was all true. Yet it was also the pitch he'd planned to give Bansu Row. Nath knew Will. Will also knew Nath, and the kid would sniff out an incomplete story.
The New Republic,
Nath said, slower and sober,
needed me to be something I'm not. Simple as that. And I'm not willing to be in that position.
You were exactly what the New Republic needed, Will said.
You were what we needed every day. You did tremendous things. You helped people. The other pilots thought the world of you.
Sure they did, Nath said,
and I enjoyed it while it lasted. But the longer I stuck around, the longer I stayed with Alphabet, the closer I got to being killed. The closer we all got to being killed because we were playing at being heroes as much as fighting a war. Will!
He paused, considered what to say and how to say it, and what he might regret later.
Will, none of us should have survived those last days. The fact all five of us from poor Aiden's working group are still alive? That makes us the luckiest sons of sows to ever jump in a cockpit. I've gambled enough to know you don't keep doubling down after a streak like that, and even if the next year or two or five are a little less risky.
He stopped again, sighed, and reoriented his thoughts.
I can live with risk. Risk's not the problem. But when I say I'm not willing to be what the New Republic needs, I mean General Syndulla would have died without resentment if she'd gone down at Jakku. I can't say the same.
I understand,
Will said. Nath eyed him dubiously, but Will shrugged and said,
I do. Looking at it that way, I'm not what the New Republic needs either. For different reasons. But neither of us are the right people to be...
He fumbled for words, then laughed sadly.
I don't know. Whatever comes next.
Glad you see it that way.
They stood in awkward silence. T5 buzzed softly and Nath rapped his knuckles on the droid's top. Will stroked a fingertip along the seam between his synth skin and organic flesh, as if brushing away something that had lodged there.
"Can I ask you something?"
he said, and Nath nodded.
"Sure. Why did you stay with us as long as you did?"
He frowned in surprise.
"You mean with the squadron?"
"With Alphabet Squadron. After Pandem Nai. Yes. Man's gotta earn a living somehow, and hell, you might as well know if no one told you. Even before I started working for Nasha Gravis, I was on Aiden's private payroll. Just in case he needed..."
"No, that wasn't..."
Will shook his head again.
"I didn't know that, but I'm really not shocked. That wasn't it in the end, though. You'd earned your money, and you were scared. What you're saying now about dying, you'd been thinking it for a while, and you kept going out there. At Chattawa, at Jakku, I saw you keep fighting. So why did you stay?"
The words roused irritation inside Nath. He tried to tamp it down.
"Why do you think?"
he asked. T5 buzzed again. Nath glared at the droid, then nodded.
"Fine. You needed me. Not only you, but the whole squadron. I probably saved all your butts at one point or another. When all of you were gone, I bailed."
"And now you're going back to piracy?"
"Something like that."
Will might or might not have known the specifics, but Nath certainly wasn't in the mood to share.
"You're not a good man,"
Will said. It should have angered him. It deserved a rough response, at least. But Will said it with such gentle conviction that Nath laughed uproariously before saying,
"Most of us aren't. Just a few who know it, though."
Will smirked and paced a few steps to his left. Then he turned back around, all humor gone.
"The thing is, you can be. When you decide to stand with someone, you're one of the most loyal people I've met. You're a natural leader. You did save all of us, more than once. And you made sure we were fit for duty. If you could surround yourself with the right crew, you could do so much for the galaxy. You don't have to sacrifice yourself or risk death all the time. You just need people you can trust to pick the right battles."
Nath released a long breath. He watched Will's soft-shoed toe dig at the paving stones. For the second time that day, he felt he was getting old.
"Come with me,"
Nath said. Now it was Will's turn to look surprised.
"What? Come with me. Be part of my new crew. You'll love it when you meet the rest of my team."
"I can't."
Will smiled sadly.
"I'm never shooting a gun again, Nath. I can't."
Nath waved the offer away.
"I know,"
he said, and he felt no disapproval, only a keen disappointment, as if some sentimental object was drifting from him in zero gravity, close yet unreachable. Neither man spoke a while. In time, Will said,
"Thank you, though,"
and brushed non-existent dust from his hands and stepped backward.
"I'm really glad you're all right."
"You too, brother,"
Nath said.
"You see any of the others, you wish them well for me."
They said a few more polite words before Will left through an archway leading out of the cloister. Nath watched him go, and when Will was finally out of sight, he clapped his hands, the sound resonating through the too quiet space.
"Could have gone worse,"
he thought.
"Could have gone better, but it could have gone worse."
T5 made a low, droning sound. Nath kicked the astromech with the side of his boot.
"What are you making noise at me for? Go after the kid."
The droid chimed and beeped, and Nath shook his head.
"I can figure out how to fly the ship. You go after him. Take care of him. He needs you, buddy."
The droid was silent. Then its rockets ignited, and it made it halfway out of the cloister in a single hop. It was rolling onward even as its dome spun, and its photoreceptor focused on Nath, watching him as it moved away. Nath laughed and gave a wave. He waited till T5, too, was gone before walking over to his Y-wing and standing in the shadow of its landing struts, staring at its scratched and carbon-scored underbelly.
"Guess I've got to add a droid to my recruiting list,"
he thought. Briefly, he considered selling the Y-Wing, but he'd been through enough changes. He wanted something familiar around. Will would be fine. T5 would be too. So would Naf Tenzin. He needed to check in on the team he'd gathered so far and keep them out of trouble before paying Bansu Ro another visit. He remained under the bomber in the cloister for a long while anyway. Night came. When he left, he was thinking about Nasha Gravis. Why was New Republic Intelligence keeping an eye on him, he wondered. And what were the odds they needed a team of deniable freelancers?
Cairn Aiden, maybe your dream will come true after all.
Three. It wasn't the nightmare, but it wasn't great either. Chasna Chaddick's mustering out pension had been reduced to 1 year thanks to her disciplinary record. 11 months after Jakku, that left her not much cash and only a month to find more. Therapy had been more frustrating than helpful, and when she'd missed an appointment, not her fault, the tram had broken down, and been told the bearded snake woman she liked at the clinic couldn't reschedule for another month.
But a droid is available right now,
the cheery desk clerk had offered. She'd given up on therapy altogether. She'd stuck around Coralag anyway, because it was where her med center was and she didn't have anywhere better to go. She'd tried getting in touch with Nath once. He'd spoken with her on the medical frigate over Jakku, and he'd told her to reach out if she needed work. But he hadn't responded by the time her messaging account was suspended, and there was no guarantee he'd received the transmission anyway. So she'd bummed around Kuramel for a while, left that city for Krulov when she'd seen the difference in rental prices, and ended up in an apartment the size of a closet in a complex occupied by death stick addicts and scrappers. She'd kind of enjoyed it. Tight quarters meant all the neighbors knew one another, though she never got a full night's sleep. Then she'd come home intoxicated after a really good evening watching the bands at the Little Orto Street Fair and found security forces raiding the building. That had ended that chapter of her life as a New Republic veteran. It hadn't gotten better from there. The dark thoughts crawled back into her head and stopped ever crawling out, even on half-decent days. Sometimes she hid her blaster just to make toying with it harder. The last push came when she spotted two children of the empty sun showing hollows of lettage outside a free clinic. She'd seen a lot of new cults sprout since Jakku, but it was the first time she'd heard anything about the children operating outside Cerberon. She'd felt a severe homesickness and an even worse nausea, and the next day she'd started pulling together credits for a shuttle off-world. She hadn't been sure where she was going, but she'd known she had to act. All this had brought Chas to where she was now, standing at the door of a small-time cargo operator on Spirina. City lights created a luminous fog to the east, but the fields around her were desolate. No one came this far into the sticks unless they had to. Chas had to. She hit the door buzzer. A minute later, the heavy metal barrier slid open, revealing a sparse waiting room with windows looking onto a private office and a landing pad. Emerging from the office was a woman in a mechanic's jumpsuit, whose stride hitched only an instant when she saw Chas.
This is a surprise, Erica Quell said.
She didn't sound surprised, though that was true to the woman Chas remembered. Not much else was. Quell held herself differently. There was a casual slouch in her usual rigid walk, and her hair looked like she'd been trying to keep it in a military style while trimming it herself. Her nose was still crooked. Chas thought about turning around, but it was too late. Leaving would have been more humiliating than staying.
You owe me, Chas said. For all the garbage you put me through, you owe me big. We agree?
Yes, Quell said.
Okay.
Chas nodded and jutted her cane at the woman's chest.
So here's the thing. I need a job, and I don't have a lot of options.
Come on in and we'll talk, Quell said. And if a hint of a smile touched her lips, it came and went so fast that Chas couldn't be sure what she saw. 4. Will Lark lived in the village of Ridge, where he'd spent most of his youth and grown to manhood. He used his days to befriend and care for the Saravkas, who'd grown old or been injured or become sick or were otherwise dependent on the village to survive. He rarely flew. He lived among the many siblings and cousins he'd loved for as long as he could remember, and spent his nights drifting among the communal homes. Yet he found himself reluctant to share stories from his years away, and too many ordinary things had changed in Ridge for him to feel like he'd never left. Ridge was still beautiful, and the people still kind. But Urn had died, and Yanda now sent children to carry cider to the houses instead of carrying it herself, and a species of bright orange flower had displaced the wild sunberries. They were small changes, yet together they informed the character of a place. Will struggled to reconcile what Ridge was now with what it had been in his mind. He had nightmares. He'd never had nightmares as a pilot, but he had them now. Others among the 120 had similar troubles, he knew. He met with them now and then, and they spoke quietly and hiked through the forests and confessed fears and the joys war had brought them, joys that shamed them now. They exchanged frustrations about their prosthetics. They all agreed that the people of home looked at them differently, and some were bitter, but most were not. These meetings were too few because the 120 came from across the planet, and arranging a gathering always proved challenging. Still, Will found the meetings reassuring. His life wasn't a bad one, as he often reminded himself. Yet neither did it feel complete. Over a year since he'd returned from his last journey off-world, his journey to see Nath Tenzant, taken in part because he'd been restless weeks after arriving. Homecoming was more difficult than he'd ever imagined, but his love for his world was undiminished. One day, having journeyed to Cliff to consult with a Sun Lama about treating a Saravka's mangled claw, Will spent the afternoon with one of Cliff's elders. He'd called Conadu his friend since he'd been 14 years old, and she had scolded him for spying on a stranger's wedding feast.
Either you're interested and you go introduce yourself and ask to learn, or you're not, and you give those poor people their privacy,
she'd told him, and they'd been close ever since.
My old caretaker,
Kana was saying as they yanked the desiccated husks of dead creeper vines off her house,
has decided at the age of 99 to become a Sun Lama, which would be perfectly fine if he didn't insist on sharing every detail of the secret lessons with me. I don't care about the esoteric teachings, but I told him I wouldn't lie if someone asks me what he's revealed.
Maybe the Sun Lamas will exile you both,
Will said with a smile. He felt a vine disintegrate in his palms as he tugged.
Oh, I'd be delighted to see them try. But I think they'd only ask me politely to leave, and I'd say no. And the punishment would be me getting the side eye for the rest of my life.
May it be a long one,
Will said, and Kana snorted. They worked in comfortable silence before she said,
You're looking healthier than last time.
She'd rarely asked directly about his struggles reacclimating. Twice he'd confessed everything anyway. She'd always been good at giving him space to speak.
It's getting better,
he said.
It's still hard.
She nodded brusquely.
Well, I'll mention this at the entirely wrong time then, since who knows when I'll see you next. The Hic-E Matriarch is talking a lot about the galaxy these days and what it means to be part of the New Republic. She's worried we're too isolationist.
Isn't isolationism one of our founding principles?
Will asked. Kana laughed.
That's what I said. But apparently she thinks it's better if we have some influence on what the New Republic is up to, unless we want to split off altogether. Me? I think she feels we've got political clout after that business rescuing everyone at Jakku, and she's loath to see it forgotten before we get anything for it.
Use the voucher before it expires,
Will said.
That's what they'd say in the purse worlds.
I know what a voucher is, Will Lark. I do read.
She shook her head, then winced as her tug at another vine sent a cloud of dirt billowing from the cliffside.
Anyway, she sent out a call, same as she did for the 120, Only this time she's looking for ambassadors and diplomats. One of them's going to get to be a senator.
Will laughed and collected debris in his arms to drop in the pile they'd gathered. When he was done, Kana stood with her back to the wall of the house, arms folded across her chest. She waggled her eyebrows.
You're not serious, he said.
You'd be good at it. You're a hero. You'd go in with credibility, she said.
I'm a deserter. That doesn't help.
Yes, but home loves you, and that means you never need to worry about re-election.
I don't know anything about politics.
You know everything about building relationships. Let your aides and the Hickey matriarch write the bills and advise on policy, at least until you figure it out. You'd be there to represent us because you understand Polinius. And you understand the galaxy, Will.
He watched her a long while, trying to understand what she saw in him.
I'll think about it,
he said. Five. 6 years after the war, they were together again. Most of them, anyway.
This guy keeps telling us, you pay for that shipment, or I'm going to come back with my men and make you pay. He's at fault, though, and he's a freaking flower salesman. We figure it's bluster.
I'm sure this story ends well.
It ends great. So one day we hear the door buzz, and there's these three Chevin brothers with hands big enough to smash your head into jelly.
Erica Quell looked across the living room table and listened to Chas and Will. Chas leaned over the lavender-smelling dessert plate that had briefly borne store-bought ice cake, almost knocking over her wine glass as she gestured. Will was less animated, but he sat straight-backed as he listened, smiling gently as recirculated air blew his hair across his scars. Erica sipped her brandy and closed her eyes.
Sees the mandala hanging on the office door and says in this deep, ridiculous voice,
"You are follower of the Church of Nine Ways?"
I'm not an idiot, so I lie and say yes.
It had been 2 years since they'd last seen Will, but they'd both been on Spirina while Will was visiting Parathol. So Erica and Chas had thrown something together, and he'd arrived at the house that evening. Erica suspected he'd gone to some trouble to arrange it. She also suspected it was more for Chas than for her, but she didn't mind. He was good company.
And suddenly it's me and Quell and the three Chevins staring down this guy, who gets real apologetic real fast.
How did we get to this topic? Erica asked.
I asked how business was,
Will said. Erica opened her eyes again.
We're doing all right. The long-term contract with the Med Center keeps us afloat. It's getting harder to make money on in-system runs, but we're not really equipped for interstellar hauling.
And she doesn't want to do it,
Chas added, falling back into her chair with a shrug.
And I don't want to do it, Erica agreed. Do you need more wine?
Chas agreed, and Will, out of politeness, Erica thought, agreed as well. And Chas and Erica asked about Will's work and the ventures he was passionate about, and whether he was still involved with the man they'd briefly met 2 years earlier. Will didn't linger on the Senate. He knew his audience. Erica didn't talk about politics, and Chas only cared about the broad strokes. Admitted he'd broken up with Tarish some months back.
Screw it, you're young,
Chas offered by way of consolation, but circled back to the second question, talking about the reconciliation project and the ongoing effort to find volunteers.
I know I ask this every time, Will said, but if you're ever willing to come and be a part...
I really can't, Erica said.
That's all right. If you're ever ready.
She nodded. The silence was broken only by Chas's collection of amulets and charms, clinking like wind chimes in front of an air vent, and by the burbling of T5 and 4E, both of whom were recharging by the front door.
Hey, Chas said, you hear anything from Nath?
Will pursed his lips and shifted uncomfortably before finally offering,
no.
You want to explain that long pause?
Chas asked. Will smiled wryly.
No.
Erica nodded. Better to leave the subject alone, she knew, and was surprised to hear herself ask,
How much trouble?
I don't know,
he said.
That's the hard thing. I don't have contacts on the Intelligence Committee anymore, and Gravis and I...
Will sighed.
He's alive. I know that. I worry about him sometimes, but what is there to do?
He made his choices, Erica said. No one can change his path but him. Her voice was harder than she'd intended. Will nodded carefully. He seemed to take no offense.
Speaking of the old days,
Will said,
did you ever look for her?
Chas appeared puzzled before enlightenment dawned on her face. The wine was slowing her down. Erica had understood instantly. Last time they'd all met, Erica had been considering searching for Kairos. She'd been haunted by dreams about a woman without a face. I didn't, she said. I was going through some things back then, but after talking it over, she indicated Chas with her head, I realized that if any of us will do fine on her own, it's her. She can find me if she wants me.
I wish I'd gotten to know her,
Will said.
I think about that time, after she was out of the suit, when I was so wrapped up in myself.
Chas snorted.
Yeah, I don't think it would have made a difference if you'd been hanging out with her.
Maybe not,
Will admitted. Erica rotated her glass and tasted her brandy again. I'm glad she got her fresh start. Talk of Nath and Kairos led to talk of General Syndulla and others, and they began down the meandering, inevitable path Erica had known they would take by evening's end. There were sidetracks, recollections of Troyth and the Special Forces crew of the Lodestar, Chas's tipsy tribute to the B-Wing, the greatest fighter ever flown. But soon they spoke of the dead. They lingered on each name for a while, giving due tribute to Sergeant Ragnell, whom Erica had known best, and Santa Neek, whom she'd never met. They spoke at length about Cairn Aiden and ITO, and about Vitali and Dennis Rave, and soon they were going around the table reciting the victims of war. Sonogari, Fatime, Ubelikos, Nehiro, Snivel. For every survivor, there were 100 dead to remember. Erica had to stop herself from offering the wrong memories. Richten, Zion, Nostein, Rada. The dead of the 204th, whom she carried as Will and Chas carried the dead of Riot and Hound squadrons. She knew it wasn't the time, so she spoke of the fallen from the Lodestar and the Deliverance instead. There were enough to go around. Eventually, the ritual came to a close. Chas was drunk by then and became fixated on heading into the city together and infiltrating the port security office.
They're bastards,
she yelled.
Human supremacist bastards.
And from what Erica had seen at customs, Chas had a point. Will insisted, calm but firm, that his senatorial credentials wouldn't get them inside. Erica promised she'd send him specifics the next time they ran into trouble. Grudgingly, Chas agreed to go to bed. The three of them stood. Chas embraced Will, then shoved him away. Then she went to Erica and, surprisingly delicately, kissed her on the lips before stumbling to the bedroom. She left her cane behind. Will helped clear the table and said nothing until closing the bottle of brandy on the counter.
From your father?
He asked. Erica shook her head, surprised.
My brother, Thren. He lives in Saint-Tropez, 300 kilometers east. How'd you know it was family?
You mentioned it once,
Will said. He gestured to the bedroom.
When did that happen, by the way?
She shrugged, feeling the stiffness in her shoulders. She remembered Will was a friend and slowly relaxed.
A while back.
It looks good on you. You needed each other.
Erica nodded and slid the dishes onto the shelves, which hummed as they began their cleaning routine. When she turned back around, Will was still watching.
She forgives you, you know,
he said.
She did a long time ago.
She pushed her back against the counter so she wouldn't sag and nodded slightly.
Maybe,
she said. She asked Will if he needed a place to spend the night, but he told her no, he had a ship waiting. So she took him by speeder to the port
and they said their goodbyes and promised not to wait so long before they met again. The wind blustered and snapped at Will's garments as he lingered outside the passenger door, T5 beside him on the dark and empty road. Erica was about to depart when he leaned in through the open speeder window and said,
"There's one other thing. There's someone I'd like you to meet, if you're willing."
She shifted uncomfortably. She wasn't fond of ambushes. "Here?"
"I wouldn't do that to you," Will said. "Someone who reached out to the Reconciliation Project. They got in touch with me. I wanted to talk to you..."
"Who?"
"A survivor."
Erica gripped the speeder's control yoke, staring past Will's left shoulder and steadying herself on the lights of a control tower.
"She was off-world when it happened," he said. "She lost family on Necronus, and she..."
"What about the recordings?" Erica asked. She bit down the tremor in her voice. "We spent enough hours making them."
"She's seen your statements and interviews. But she wants to meet one-on-one with some of the pilots who didn't cooperate. She says it's for closure. The project director thinks she wants to change their minds. I just think it would go better if she met you before she heads to the prison. Nothing official. Just a conversation."
"Okay," she said.
"I know it's not easy."
"I said okay." Will looked like he wanted to reach out to her, but the door was in the way. He stroked T5 instead and thanked her, and she managed to smile and said goodbye again, and sped away before he could say more. She breathed a sigh of relief when she was on the road. She didn't hold the request against him. It was part of the work. Back at the house, behind the cargo office, she checked on Chas, feeling sad and tired and glad they'd all had the evening. She sat by the bed a while, toying with Chas's cane. She'd brought it in from the living room without thinking. And when Chas woke, Erica apologized for disturbing her. Chas only grunted and asked,
"Will want anything?" "He always wants something."
"Nothing important," Erica said. "Go to sleep." Chas rolled onto her side and dragged a pillow across her face. Her muffled voice asked,
"You coming?"
"In a while." When she was sure Chas was sleeping soundly, she left the house again and climbed into the cargo shuttle, a Helotech load hauler she'd bought from a junkyard and spent the better part of 6 months refitting and persuading to fly. The design was an unauthorized knockoff of the Empire's old Zeta-class vessels, but the parts were cheaper, and it lacked the Zeta's armament. Erica liked that about the load hauler. It was noisy and wobbled and got hot as a star on atmospheric entry. But she hadn't flown a starfighter or anything else with weapons since Coruscant. Since she'd condemned what was left of the Empire to face what they'd all done. She'd followed the hearings and trials when her heart allowed it. Stepped away and focused on her work when it didn't. She'd never put in to get her record expunged. She still couldn't vote or take government contracts. And she wasn't in any hurry. It was the same reason she'd turned Will down more than once when he'd asked her to join the Reconciliation Project full-time. She'd forfeited her right to speak and to judge. She started the shuttle, and it lifted off the tarmac. She felt herself smile as air rushed beneath her and wind pushed at her wings, and she plotted a parabolic course that would take her up into orbit, then down at the best speed the ship could muster. She loved to fly. Whatever happened next, she didn't want to give up flight. As acceleration pushed her into her seat, she thought about the dead she hadn't spoken of with Chas and Will. She thought about Grandmother and Gablerone, Tonus and Barath. She thought about her mentor and everything that had shaped Soren Keyes into what he'd been. A murderer and a soldier and a fierce protector of his people, who'd left an indelible stain on her soul and freed her from the Empire. She thought about Necronus and all those who had died there. She would never stop thinking about Necronus. But Erica Quell soared, and it was joyful. This is January Lavoie. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Star Wars, Victory's Price by Alexander Freed. This program was produced and directed by Scott Cresswell. Executive producer, Nick Martorelli. Edited by Chris Benelli. Post-production and sound mixing by Scott Cresswell. Star Wars, Victory's Price is a production of Lucasfilm Limited and registered or trademarked where indicated. Copyright 2021, all rights reserved. Used under authorization. Music composed by John Williams. Music publishing by Warner Tamerlane Publishing Corporation and Bantha Music. Music Master Production Copyright 2007, Lucasfilm Limited. This has been a Penguin Random House audio presentation. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.